Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Seeing Through the Fog, Transitional Governments in Libya and Elsewhere by Dr. John B. Alterman, Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is the first lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. John B. Alterman is Director and Senior Fellow of the Middle East Program at CSIS. Prior to joining CSIS, he served as a member of the policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State and as a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. He is a member of the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel and served as an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. In addition to his policy work, he teaches Middle Eastern Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the George Washington University. Before entering government, he was a scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace and at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. From 1993 to 1997, Dr. Alterman was an award-winning teacher at Harvard University, where he received his Ph.D. in history. He also worked as a legislative aide to Senator Daniel Monahan, responsible for foreign policy and defense. Dr. Alterman has lectured in more than 25 countries on subjects related to the Middle East and U.S. policy toward the region. He is the author or co-author of 4 books on the Middle East and the editor of 2 more. His opinion pieces have appeared in numerous major publications. He is on the board of advisory editors of the Middle East Journal, is a member of the editorial advisory board of Arab Media and Society, and is a former International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he is now a life member. Dr. Alterman received his AB from Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. This lecture took place Thursday, 6 October 2011, at the Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Welcome. We are very honored to have 4 members of our Board of Visitors, Dr. Atkin, Dr. Fields, Dr. Baker, and Dr. Morris. Very, very honored to have you, Jun Rowdy, sir. Thank you for your support always. Ladies and gentlemen, officers, enlisted Marines, and any other services that you're here. Welcome to the first Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University Lecture Series for the academic year 2011-2012. Those of you who have been with us in the previous year, 2 years ago we had a similar lecture series consisting of 7 lectures on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And each one of these is 1 per month. So then last academic year, we concentrated on Iran. This year, given what was happening last year within the Arab world in general, and the impact of that, not only for the United States Marine Corps, but for all the countries of that region and beyond, because of what the Middle East has, we decided, and it was approved by our leadership, to concentrate on what we call the Arab Spring. But the idea is to concentrate on one country or a number of countries each month. Today is the starting month. We will be discussing Libya. I can tell you the next one will be on 9th November, not in here, but in the room behind you. It will be on the country of Saudi Arabia. And December will be Syria. Next year, we may actually go for one country which is not a country where an uprising has taken place, and that's the Republic of Turkey. We will look at Turkey's impact and their role in this upheaval. And most likely we might have in spring a panel on a few countries of the GCC presented by representatives from those countries. But we will keep you posted. If you're not on our mailing list and wish to be, please either see myself or you'll be better off seeing Adam Seitz, who's standing right to the left, and you will get on our mailing list. We try to disseminate information as much as possible, but if you give your name, you definitely will receive that information. Most of the proceeds of these conferences, if the authors give us a paper, we'll publish it, either in forms of edited volumes, or in the forms of monograms. Some of you may have picked up a package there, and if there are not enough packages, you want more, please see Adam. This is a monograph by Mr. Eisenstadt from the Washington Institute for Near East Studies. This was from last year. Very soon, we'll have another one of these monographs by Dr. Anthony Kohlesman, also in Iran. But we'll have other monographs of Libya, for example, which are not part of the lecture series. We also have other publications which are they're all online, by the way. But if you want paper copies, again, please see us. The Office of Middle East Studies is upstairs, second deck, 201. You know, I don't want to take any more time from our guest. It gives me personally a very, very distinct pleasure to start this series with someone that I not only consider a very, very dear friend, but also someone, although just telling our distinguished members of Board of Visitors here, someone that I consider to be kind of a mentor. Even though we've never worked together, I've always looked up to him, I have followed what he writes. Washington is full of experts. Washington has a lot of gentlemen. The combination thereof sometimes is very rare. I mean, he's one of those who not only knows what he talks about, he's also a very, very good person who understands it within the context. And there are a lot of people in this town that we have who, by reading a book, consider themselves experts of a region. That you will not see in Dr. Alterman. He has a very, very distinguished career. And maybe someone who has, you know, you have his biography there, but currently he is the director and senior fellow of the Middle East program at CSIS. I was just telling him in my office upstairs, when I was hired here to start the Middle East Studies as a one-person show, I only knew of one other person who had a Middle East Studies with one person, and that was him. So I kind of followed what he did, and I actually, we have stolen some of his ideas. I told him that so that we can make it public. Dr. Alterman, prior to joining CSIS, served as a member of the policy planning staff at the United States State Department and as a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. He is a member of the Chief of Naval Operations Executive Panel and served as an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, also known as the Baker-Hamilton Commission. In addition to his policy work, he teaches Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University of Advanced International Studies and the George Washington University. Before entering government, he was a scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace and at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. From 1993 to 1997, John Alterman was an award-winning teacher at Harvard University, where he received his PhD in history. And also, another thing that puts us in contact or commonality is his work with a senator who partially is responsible for my becoming an American citizen, and that's the late Patrick Moynihan of New York, where John worked with him in his office. So, welcome, and thank you for accepting my invitation.
Thank you. There is something ironic about trying to understand Libya in comparison with other countries. For more than four decades, Libya's leadership tried to make Libya sort of sui generis, a country that defied convention to create its own peculiar form of government. Famously, Libya wasn't a republic, it wasn't a jumhuriya in Arabic, it was a jamahiriya, a government of the masses. Muammar Gaddafi, who led Libya since he seized power in 1969, said, I don't have any governmental role whatsoever. I have a position with the government. People just ask me what I think. The government had no traditionally elected representatives. They said they had this system of direct democracy, which goes right down to your neighborhood level and somehow bubbles up to a prime minister. In point of fact, Libya was always more subject to the rules of reality than anyone in Libya ever wanted to admit. Libya had a genuine economy, although it was a terribly distorted economy. It had a fierce intelligence apparatus. And its emphasis on talking about direct democracy was an effort to divert attention from the fact that it wasn't a democracy at all. Despite utopian aspirations, Libya had social problems as well. In the early days of a reestablished diplomatic presence in Libya, one intrepid foreign service officer even wrote a cable about prostitution in the country. It was entitled, of course, To the Whores of Tripoli. The demise of the Gaddafi clique leaves us in a quandary as to what Libya's future is and what role the United States might play in steering things in a positive direction. Seen in isolation, Libya's never really been a strategic asset or a strategic adversary of the United States. Libya's been troublesome, it's been mercurial, but the United States government has found ways to work with it or around it as the situation dictated. Now, in a period of broader transition in the Middle East, a successful outcome in Libya can have a broader impact as a model for interaction between the United States and for interactions between transitional governments and the outside world on the one hand, and the United States and like-minded allies confronting complex contingencies on the other. To do so is to wade into the very dangerous territory of making Libya into some sort of model, which it desperately but unsuccessfully tried to do for itself for more than four decades. Even if Libya doesn't emerge as a new model, drawing on other experiences can and should help guide the way we think about Libya going forward. We have important and enduring interests in Libya, from helping to establish, helping to restore access to Libyan energy, to counterterrorism, to getting a handle on the large quantities of Gaddafi's weapons that are draining out of storehouses and already appearing in conflict zones throughout the region. There's no magic solution to making complex contingencies work, and there's no course of action that will guarantee success or even make success likely. Still, there's some things to keep in mind that will help us avoid making obvious mistakes, and others that will help us right-size our expectations. And what I want to do is highlight six of those things. Three have to do with governmental transitions in general, and three have to do with the particulars of Libya itself. None of them are determinative, but collectively it seems to me to advise modestly in the types of outcomes we should expect in Libya and in our ability to shape the new environment. Still, this analysis should help us prioritize where we invest our efforts and how we pace ourselves in the current period of regional turmoil. And the first issue involves exactly that, pace. It will likely take years for the character of Libya's transition to become clear and recognizable. The classic example of this is Iran, where there is considerable public hostility to the Shah in the United States for his poor human rights record, and great optimism that a broad opposition coalition that included Ayatollah Khomeini, liberal nationalists, and money interests from the merchant class could lead Iran to a better future. Support for the Iranian revolution in the United States didn't only come from the radical fringe. Serious academics, such as Princeton's Richard Falk, Colombia's Nicholas Saeed and others argue that the Islamic revolution in Iran should not be alarming because it was really based on universal aspirations of social justice. The first prime minister of revolutionary Iran, Mehdi Bazargan, served for 9 months before he was purged for being insufficiently revolutionary. But for the first 9 months after the fall of the Shah, there was somebody who he felt we could deal with. Part of the reason Bazargan was sacked was because he was photographed having a friendly chat with our national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Brzezinski is no softie. 9 months into this, it was still somebody we were talking to. An article in the Establishment-Oriented Foreign Affairs in the autumn of 1980 said it wasn't yet time to get alarmed with Khomeini's consolidation of power behind the revolutionary religious establishment. because the country was so beset with problems, we don't really know yet. Other examples of slow-rolling revolutions are Cuba under Castro and Egypt under Abdel Nasser. In both cases, Americans initially saw the leaders as anti-imperialists and as nationalists. As the United States has its own long history of being both anti-imperialist and nationalist, few in the United States saw these governments or the people who led them as threats. In the case of Fidel Castro, a shrewd anti-communist you may have heard of, Richard Nixon, said Fidel is the sympathetic figure and the real danger is his brother Raul, who ironically is the one who's now dismantling the communist apparatus that Fidel created. But Richard Nixon said we can work with Fidel, it's Raul who's the problem. In Egypt, the U.S. government actively courted Gamal al-Nasser after the Egyptian coup of 1952, but British resistance to U.S. arms sales in the midst of negotiations over British troop withdrawals from Egypt helped push Egypt toward the Eastern Bloc for weaponry. The non-aligned movement that Egypt helped create in 1955 was a clear contravention to U.S. plans for the developing world and opened a period of Egyptian-American tensions that scarcely diminished for two decades. Despite the slowness of these governments to reveal their true essence, they had an advantage that made the process clearer than the one we're likely to see in Libya. In each of these cases, the movements that took power had clear and charismatic leaders who led the government and public toward a new status quo. In Libya, no charismatic figure appears to be in the leadership, and none appear to be on the horizon. It appears that this charisma map is part of the legacy of Gaddafi. The government shaped people's professional development in such a way as to make true leadership impossible, except for the leader, Gaddafi. Learning patterns of leadership and adapting patterns of followership that are healthier than those that existed under Gaddafi is likely to extend this period of uncertainty, already long in transition situations, to be even longer. All of this is to say that while there will be keen scrutiny of the development of Libyan politics for the next year or beyond, the period of uncertainty and change is likely to endure long after most Americans and Europeans have moved on to other challenges. This isn't to predict the failure or success of Libyan's transition, but rather to suggest that it's likely to last far longer than anybody is currently planning for. The second point, and it's related to this first point, is that the United States government is often bureaucratically divided in its analysis of such movements in transition. This was especially clear in the case of Iran, where the State Department was relatively optimistic about the course a post-Shah Iran would take, and National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski was more skeptical. For her own part, First Lady Rosalynn Carter reportedly carried on a private correspondence with the Shah's wife before his application, surely confusing the Iranians as well as others in the U.S. government as to exactly what the policy of the U.S. government was. It's worth unpacking this a little because I think the problem is deeper than merely differences of analysis. Unsurprisingly, different government agencies maintain different contacts in foreign countries that help shape their view of the host government. This is true as much in normal times as in transitional situations. Times in which the leadership is uncertain and things are in flux should be precisely the time of maximum information sharing, comparing notes, coordination, so as to gain a more complete picture of an uncertain situation. But in practice, the bureaucratic process drives agencies to hoard information rather than share it, and use information to wage battles for influence that in some way mirror the battles that are happening on the ground. One might argue that these kinds of differences of opinion are both natural and healthy, and under such circumstances, it's incumbent on the National Security Council to act as the arbiter. And arguably, that's what the National Security Council is supposed to do. It's supposed to gather the information and array it for the president to choose. But in times of governmental transition, what most often happens is the NSC takes on the role that it did in the Iran case. The NSC becomes an actor itself. It's a player in negotiations. It's not the referee. It puts forward its own analysis and backs its own interpretation of the facts. So while the goal of the interagency process is to synthesize the forces and emerge with a fully vetted whole, in practice, the interagency process has often led to governmental paralysis. In this way, rather than having a wide variety of information about transitional governments helping the United States government to act effectively, it's more often prevented the government from acting much at all. Some would argue that this paralysis is helpful because it curbs an overzealous interventionist instinct and preserves the United States from getting way out of position. It does that, but maybe it does that more than would be ideal. The third thing we know from transitions is that neighbors have a profound impact on their outcome. It stands to reason that proximity gives outsized influence, especially because it allows opposition groups and other political aspirants to have a safe haven outside a country's borders. In addition, neighboring countries often have a relatively fine-grained understanding of the domestic politics of surrounding states, linguistic and ethnic and family ties, reciprocal travel, and the sustained focus on neighbors are not determinative in every case, but in most cases give neighbors a better understanding of politics than countries half a world away. In addition, the stakes of a transition are almost always higher for neighbors than they are for global powers, focusing their minds on accomplishing positive outcomes. Neighbors are important both for how they align with U.S. interests and how they complicate. Iraq and Afghanistan are recent examples where neighbors have often been unhelpful in founding the U.S.-backed transitions by supporting insurgents and meddling in the broader political process. Even earlier, during Yemen's civil war in the 1960s, it was the clash between Egypt and Saudi Arabia that did much to define how Yemen would fit into the regional balance of power or beyond U.S. decisions to support the U.S. The same has been true of Saudi involvement this year in Ukraine, albeit in a different way. All these things tell us something about transitions in general, that they take time to evolve, that the U.S. government often constrains its own role through internal divisions, and that neighboring states often play an outsized role in influencing outcomes. But they don't really tell us anything specific about Libya. And while we've talked about Libya's uniqueness, even that uniqueness offers solutions to events in other countries, and I want to offer you three here. First, compared to other successful oppositions, Libya's opposition is of relatively recent origin and was forged out of a relatively short battle. Why is that a problem? Well, compare this to the Solidarity movement in Poland, which built itself over 15 years before coming to power. How many supporters in Iran who built their movement over a decade, and Fidel Castro's movement in Cuba, built on 6 years of guerrilla activity. Think even of the ANC in South Africa, who built itself up in one form or another for 80 years during apartheid. These gestational periods allow groups to forge and to develop ideologies, to create internal leadership structures, and to form constituencies. Of course, running a secret movement creates its own set of pathologies, but it also creates leaders who have genuine legitimacy and helps train them to speak effectively with broader publics. Equally important, these movements represent opportunities to develop an organizational culture and for individuals to build relationships of trust across responsibilities that help governments function better when they come to power. The fact that really few opposition movements ever do come to power, if you look around the world, there are a lot of opposition movements, and very few of them ever come to power. But that's good, because if you succeed, that means you've survived this sort of Darwinian competition, right? You have done something if you can have an opposition movement that can make its way and sustain itself. But Libya hasn't had that advantage. In a way, this long struggle for independence is a way to develop immunity from the kinds of ills that afflict new governments. Libya's opposition, as I said, didn't undergo the same process of building immunity, but it's put into an environment that's swarming with pathogens. The PNC's ability to unite against the leader rather than behind the leader was one of its initial strengths in uniting all these constituencies, but it presents a challenge in the post-Gaddafi milieu. Not only is the transitional government a broad coalition of groups, many of which are armed, but many also have different external sponsors. While the contract group process resulted in international imprimatur for the TNC, it wasn't able to resolve differences within the TNC. In addition, many of the TNC's leadership came from senior positions in the Gaddafi regime. Most notably, Mustafa Ahmadinejad, who was formerly Libya's Minister of Justice and is now the chairman of the TNC. Others were close to Gaddafi's modernizing son, Saif al-Islam, who some Libyans saw representing the best chance for evolutionary change in living. Having them into an internal political experience isn't bad. To the contrary, it holds out the promise of a more inclusive political order in Libya at the end of the day. While a longer period of political struggle would offer more opportunities for former regime figures to gain Bouteflika's as forces for change, short-circuiting this process will make it a more contentious battle. This isn't a recipe for failure, but it's a recipe for conflict. And there are few battle-tested political leaders to guide the resolution of this conflict. That's number one. They haven't had a lot of time to figure out what they're doing. Many insurgent political movements in other countries have had a sort of deep nationalist core, and nationalism is a really uncertain quality in Libya. The quintessential kind of nationalist movement is an anti-colonial struggle, right? We've seen lots of those around the world. And we've certainly seen that in the Middle East. Much of the same nationalist sentiment guided the Eastern European political movements in the 1980s and 90s, driven by a desire to reclaim national culture from the homogenizing effect of Soviet-induced conformity. In Iran and Cuba and elsewhere, there was a deep sense that the leadership was obsessed with foreign approval and that somehow sought to undermine its natural and good developed nations. Nationalism is a force. It's often a powerful force. The Libyan nation-state, as we all know, is a colonial creation. Stuck together three Ottoman provinces under Italian rule in the 1930s. It's a country that didn't win its independence through rebellion, but because the Libyans lost World War II. The UN got saddled with these guys and said, go off on your own. In 1951, sent them off on their own. Gave the country to King Idris. He ruled relatively ineffectively with a light hand for 18 years before being pushed aside by Muammar Gaddafi, who moved the capital from Benghazi to Tripoli and sought to destroy all their governments in the border. So what we have, rather than a sort of deep historical memory of Libya, something that this new government can draw on, we have a rather shallow nationalism that lionizes one guy, this anti-Italian rebel named Omar al-Mukhtar, who died 80 years ago. And it really doesn't agree on anything else. Gaddafi so twisted the national identity in part by setting up Libya as a utopian universalist state, and in part by playing Tripolitania off against Cyrenaica, his two main provinces on the coast, it's hard to understand what at all is left of the notion of what is it to be Libyan. Indeed, what seems to constitute most of the Libyan national identity is having survived Gaddafi. How that essentially negative definition is replaced by something positive remains to be seen. Because there's so little past to rely on, a forward-looking nationalism may emerge to be more inclusive and optimistic than many other post-conflict situations, yet defining that nationalism will almost certainly be contentious as well. That's all bad news. I keep talking to people and say, that's bad news. How do you get up in the morning? There's some good news. At least be honest if you're interested in Libya sticking together.
Thanks.
All this stuff suggests a difficult path and forces to argue for conflict and not the dissolution of the state. But a final factor worth keeping in mind about Libya is a unifying one. There's a lot of money in Libya and a future stream of money that's likely to give huge advantages to whoever is able to establish control over it. To give a sense of scale, the Gaddafi government had about $70 billion in its sovereign wealth fund alone, some of which became the property of the TNC when it recognized a legitimate government. In addition, Libyan oil and gas production generates approximately $37 billion a year in annual revenues to the state. The combination represents a huge resource base for the Libyan government, especially considering the fact that you only have to spread it among 6 million citizens. Right? So there's lots of money going to the state. That isn't to say that oil will make it easier for Libya to be successful, whatever that means, and however you want to define success in Libya. There's an extensive academic literature on resource curves, which I won't bore you with. The short version is that countries that discover natural resources early in their political development not only rarely emerge as democracies, but they also often end up staying poor. Time after time, a tiny number of people monopolize access to resources and most people who have to eke out a living. The problem is more acute the larger the proportion of the overall economy resource revenues represent. In places like Indonesia, where you have a lot of people who are making money not by natural resources, it tends not to be dispositive. In a place like the Congo, where really the only economy is a resource-driven economy, it tends to lead to really bad outcomes. In the oil-rich Arab states, we've seen a relatively high degree of diffusion of resources, but a relatively low degree of political pluralism. The Kuwaiti parliament, whatever its many failings, has actively pushed for greater distribution of oil wealth to Kuwaiti nationals. In fact, arguably, the only thing they do is figure out ways to take all the oil wealth and hand it out to Kuwaiti nationals. In Saudi Arabia, the ruling family is supremely wealthy, but a formerly impoverished Bedouin population is now urbanized, educated, and relatively well-managed. Libya, for example, this pattern, although the outrageous inefficiencies of Gaddafi state reduce the benefits individual Libyans realize from the country's petroleum wealth. In each of these circumstances, oil wealth has given rulers the ability to co-opt and coerce potential rivals, making the benefits of allegiance and the costs of opposition extremely high. Not surprisingly, most people choose allegiance, even in situations where conflict would otherwise seem more likely. An interesting case study in this regard is Iraq, another state with the colonial powers wove together out of a set of modern provinces. Iraq had a forceful integrating leadership in the post-war era, despite the ethnic and tribal diversity of the country. Yet, more than a decade of virtual independence for the Kurdish North, combined with the fact that Kurds remained ethnically and linguistically distinct from Iraqi Arabs, gave lead to Kurdish separatism that many anticipated after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Oil money plays some part of this, as do oil disputes in areas of mixed ethnic makeup, such as Kirkuk. The bottom line, it seems, is that the cost of dissolving Iraq would be high for all sides, and it's preferable to work out even financial, it's preferable to work out financial arrangements based on the country's abundant oil resources than to rend the fabric of Iraqi life. Oil, it seems to me, is a special kind of resource in a world of resource curses in the politics that flow from it. Oil is bulky, it's hard to move, and it requires a lot of infrastructure. Loading terminals often cost billions of dollars to construct, and pipelines, refineries, and a host of other associated costs make this the sort of project that only a government can undertake. You may have some small-scale smuggling, sure, especially when products are available at a subsidized price, as they are in Iran. But insurgent groups can't develop an oil infrastructure, and multinational oil companies are loath to invest in an infrastructure where the risk is too high. Compare that situation, where the advantage goes to governments, and governments buying off their opposition and bringing the opposition in, to a resource like diamonds, which are a valuable commodity that's easily transported. There could be conflict diamonds in West Africa for precisely that reason, testing territorial integrity and stoking civil war. For the same reason, it's hard to imagine you can have conflict oil. There's no way insurgent groups can get a hold of oil in serious quantities. With oil, the advantages lie wholly with governments, not people who seek undermining them. What's absent from all of this, my 6 points, is a clear sense of what will happen in Libya. If you came here and expected that, I apologize. It's also absent sort of any way the U.S. can force a predetermined outcome. But rather than be a problem, that strikes me as a reflection of reality. For more than a half century, our archetypal post-war reconstructions are Germany and Japan. Through American efforts, deeply fractured societies were made whole, armies were demobilized, and warlike spirits that had worried neighbors for decades were transformed into peaceful economic engines that continue to help drive the global economy. Yes, it required large numbers of occupation troops. Yes, it required the abject surrender of the country's leadership. And yes, it required the top-level U.S. focus that lasted for years. But we forget it. And we keep thinking about Germany and Japan. We did that, right? It's become popular to blame the prolonged domestic post-war environments in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Bush administration's missteps. And it will. Yet the true blame rests on those who failed to estimate the likelihood of those messy environments after U.S. military action. By creating high expectations for the rapidity and cleanness of the post-war environment, the administration set itself up for failure. To my mind, the Obama administration has avoided many of these traps in Libya, playing a constructive role in reconstruction, but avoiding ownership of reconstruction. The administration has also been blessed by incredibly good luck, not least in the relatively peaceful fall of Tripoli. We gathered a bunch of Libya experts in late July, and very proudly wrote this up. Point one, universal agreement in the documents that we gave to the State Department and NSC and everywhere else. It's going to be a nasty siege of Libya. This isn't going to be fast. It's going to be terrible. What did you have? Really good luck. But with looming budget battles and unfolding political campaign challenges throughout the Middle East, it's going to be difficult for the administration to put a focus on Libya for the next year. That, it seems to me, is appropriate, as we have few vital interests at stake and only a limited amount of influence on the ground. But we have some influence with which we should engage the Libyans, their neighbors, and our allies to help build a post-Gaddafi environment that is both orderly and peaceful. Libyans have a chance to get this transition right, and the United States has an opportunity to help, but we won't be able to judge that effort for another decade. It's an uphill road, but not an impossible one, and Libyans, not Americans, will decide the outcome. Thank you.
Stand up, identify yourself, there's a mic in the back that will come to you and ask your question. Yes, please.
Sir, Major Roich, Commanded Staff College. You mentioned earlier in your remarks about the theft of a lot of weapons and munitions. Do you know anything more about it? Can you tell us anything more about it, such as was it deliberate or was it just spot opportunities to pillage? Or do you know what kind of systems they were, how much, where did they go, et cetera? Anything, any applications to the war on terror?
I was hoping for an NTIA briefing afterwards and go through all these issues. There were huge stockpiles of weapons. As far as anybody can tell, the Army dissolved in fits and starts. There are certainly, I was in Morocco in March, and one of the guys in the Foreign Intelligence Service told me, we are really worried that the stuff is getting out. We're starting to see stuff getting out. Even when troops left their things on the battlefield, some of them were being stolen for money. The stockpiles that have been raided are huge. I mean, really huge. And there are going to be some entrepreneurial people who see this as a business opportunity. I cannot tell you, because I simply don't know what we're doing with Libyans, what we're doing with our allies, what we're doing anywhere to try to figure out what this stuff is, tag it, and keep it from falling into their hands. There's a lot of press about the MANTADs. Everybody who knows about the MANTADs, when they talk to me, they're very skittish and say, I can't talk about this. MANTAD stuff is a big deal. I think we are going to be dealing with this for many years to come. I don't think this was an orchestrated decision by Gaddafi. I don't think this was an orchestrated decision that this is somebody's money-making opportunity. I think you have a lot of people who are trying to be entrepreneurial. And there's a lot of money floating around, a lot of money to be had for selling. I think we're going to be dealing with that. I mean, not just, you've seen some of it show up in the Israeli conflict, we've seen some of it showing up in the Sahara. I mean, this stuff would be shocked if you don't see a lot of it in Yemen. You know, Yemenis also had a good deal where they would, Yemeni arms trade is a long and sad story involving Iraq and other places. So, I think we're, as a consequence, we're going to see a lot of weapons to insurgent groups for some time to come throughout the region and even beyond. It's not the happy answer.
Please.
Sir, Major Shaw with Command and Staff College. One of the questions I had was, reading the Sinjar papers and the second largest population that was supporting the insurgency in Iraq came from Libya. Some percentage of them survived. You know, some percentage of them weren't captured. Is there any indication, or have you come across any information to say that some percentage of those have an effect, or having an effect, or what your what do you think their effect might be as they do start to repatriate or start to come back to Libya, or if they're already there?
I think you're going to have a range of outcomes. In the first place, you have like Belhaj, who we had transferred our addition to Libya, who seems to now be a rebel leader we like, who helped lead the fall of Tripoli. So there are some group of people who seem to have, at least to our way of thinking, turned around and seem to be part of a broader Libyan whole. The fact that there are no U.S. troops, there are some people for whom this is an anti-Western thing, and if you're concerned with Libyan nationalism, that's not their problem, and you could see them sort of be integrated. I arguably could say that their vision of the West has changed because of the role the West played in Libya. I would imagine that there are some crazy murderous guys who have come back who are going to be a problem. How you tell the first group from the second group from the third group, I don't know. I think one of the important things is to keep track of who everybody is. And the Libyans have to learn. I think I saw an article somewhere where they're doing biometric sort of tagging of people just to sort of keep track of who everybody is. I think those sorts of things are very helpful. It's going to be a very messy intelligence situation, figuring out who these people are, what their experience is, what their intentions are, and how they're working together. Certainly, there's an article, I think, in the New York Times today or yesterday, talking about the extent to which people in Tripoli are really tired of guys coming in from outside Tripoli with guns. Well, that's going to be a difficult thing to negotiate. Especially because people say, well, we helped liberate the country, so now it's our turn to fail. They don't people in Tripoli who have been benefiting from the government. So who are these people? We live in Tripoli, we built a nice environment for ourselves, get the mountain boys out of here. And you can see a lot of potential division lines, which requires leadership to overcome. Sir.
Chuck Lewis from Marion University. You talk kind of a gap in charismatic leaders. Right now, if one were to emerge, what kind of story or narrative would you weave that would be successful in coalescing Libyan nationalism?
It's a question I struggle with, not really the Libyan case, but more broadly in the Middle East, where you had a set of charismatic leaders in the 1960s and 70s, and then a rise of bureaucratic leaders, really, in the 80s and 90s, but not the same type of charismatic leaders. But you really have the decline of charismatic leaders, and with the rise of satellite television and all these communications mechanisms people have, I think one of the questions we have to think about and think hard about is, are we in a post-charismatic age in the Middle East, or are we in a place where we're likely to see charismatic leaders arise from the demise of the old system, which were colorless, giving rise to something else? And if it's charismatic, what's the basis of that prison? Is it going to be anti-Western? Is it going to be pro-Islamic? Is it going to be some mix of those things? I can guess, but I honestly don't know where that's going to go. And I think if you're thinking strategically about the next 30 years in the Middle East, I think one of the really important questions that nobody's asking that is useful to work through in your head is, are we in a post-charismatic age where you're going to have colorless leaders and a lot of improvisation on the ground? Or is somebody going to really unify countries, groups of countries? My guess is toward the post-charismatic, because the governments that own most of the satellite television stations don't want to take the risk of allowing paramedic leaders to arise. But that's a guess and not a guarantee, and I think we have to continue to look for people who defy that paradigm, because that's something that come out of nowhere and really change the reality in a year.
Sir, Nicholas Buescher, head of Command Staff College. Which government do you see having the most influence in establishing rule of law in Libya in this transitional state in the Mediterranean region?
My reading of it from afar is that the Libyans are sort of doing good things about both Abdel Zabio, the chairman, and Ali Talhouni, the U.S. academic. He seems to have some street cred getting things done. I think one of the danger signs that we haven't thought through enough is some sort of malicious action or undermining action coming across the border into Algeria. The Algerians were never wholly on board with this international effort. They have their own interests in Libya. They're part of Gaddafi's family, and I'm not sure that we have the same mind meld with the Algerians or with the future of Libya that we have with other countries in the region. I think that's a place where I put a lot of effort. But you know, Algeria is a hard country for us. You know, we don't have an easy and natural relationship with the Algerians that we have with many of the leaders in the region. So revolutionary government, there's still some revolutionary coloration. A sort of an opaque military leadership. It's not the easiest set of bilateral relations we have, but I think in the Libyan case, it's very important.
Colonel Morton, sir, Commander Staff College. Kind of a follow-on question from that last one. Given, as you said, what would likely be a limited role, maybe a vaccine role for the United States in the future of Libya, if not principally based on our challenges elsewhere and being spread too thin. What is the future? What do you see the role with Europe in Libya in their future, especially when you consider Muslim populations in Europe, the economic crisis in Europe, and their ability to do anything that might assist Libya in their future? Can you speak to that at all?
Sure. There aren't a lot of Libyans in Europe. There aren't all Libyans anymore. You have 33 million Algerians, and you have 10% of France's population is now Muslim, a lot of whom are from Algeria. You have other populations from other places, countries. But Libya doesn't have this huge European presence because it's just not a huge country. It's a relatively sparsely populated country. What the European interest is in Libya is in the energy trade. That's where they get a lot of their gas from. It gives them a way not to get gas from the Russians, which gives them a lot of security. It's a close place to get oil from. It's very high quality crude that comes out of Libya. So there's a keen European financial interest and geostrategic interest in having Libya stable and producing energy. That gives them, I think, a heightened incentive to try to make Libya work. You've seen France be very forward-leaning on this stuff. The Italians have a long history with Libya. I think the Italians are going to be very aggressive. Other countries, probably less so, the British have been involved in largely for energy reasons. I would expect that there's three European countries, France, the UK, and Italy, are going to be quite aggressive trying to create some sort of stable order, plus reinvigorate the energy business, because it's in their interest, and it's deeply in their interest, and they're hurting without living.
Thank you.
Counselor, my name is, take you away from Libya and into the there's an argument out there that because of the action in Libya, for some people seem that what
the United Nations Security Council authorized and what they did, there was a difference. The assumption by non-NATO members is that NATO perhaps stepped a bit beyond what the Security Council has authorized. Let us say if that's, first of all, do you agree to that or not? But the second issue is it possible to foresee another coalition, whether we are leading from the behind or we are leading ahead, to do certain action perhaps in a country such as Syria, or the Libyan experience has, at least for the foreseeable future, came to any coalition building within the United Nations system?
I think that there are a number of reasons why Libya is different from Syria. One of the two of the most important, one is the energy equation. The second is that Gaddafi had so alienated other regional states. I mean, he tried to assassinate King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia when he was crown prince in 2003. He quit the Arab League, I don't know how many times, because, well, at least once because they didn't pay his white book, which had a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. We keep sending your envoys over. He has a solution, it's to create his routine. And he wrote it all, and the Arab League was like, what are you talking about? And then he quit, you know? And he had sort of insulted and stormed off and done so many things. The Arab world was really delighted to see the end of him. And having Arab cover for this, when I think we're so gun-shy after Iraq about, you know, war and Islam and everything else, having the Emiratis and the Qataris and the Kuwaitis and Jordanians really forward any on this, I think made people a lot more comfortable with the idea of military action in the Arab world in a way they wouldn't be. Syria's Arabness is intrinsic to Syria. Right? Syria is all about its Arabness. Syria's never walked away from the Arab League. It would be much harder to get that kind of regional cover that the military can gain against Syria. Not to mention it's a larger country, it's a more complex geography, the post-war environment in Syria would be much more dangerous. I don't think we can go there. What I think you have as a consequence of Libya is you have Europeans sort of take a vault. Because they assume that they knew how all these joint operations would work. And they didn't anticipate they would be running out of ammunition. They didn't anticipate that the United States wouldn't do everything for them and have a little European chapeau on it. I mean, I think that the administration quite successfully signaled that joint operations have to be joint. And you guys have to be serious about your defense budgets and your capabilities and your weapon stocks and everything else. Because the United States is not going to do what the United States would do in 1962. We're not in 1962 anymore. How Europe adjusts to that reality, which is partly a military reality, partly a diplomatic reality, I think it is shaped by what happened in Iraq, it's shaped by what happened in Afghanistan. But the fact that we have sort of been through an iteration in Libya suggests to me that the real enduring consequence of this is creating a different model for how the world deals with complex conditions. It's not the United States plus. People can't just ride on their coattails. But people have to do stuff. And I think that reality is likely to shape the incidence of interventions, the nature of those interventions for some time to come.
The nature of NATO.
I think NATO, NATO was headed for a decision about what it was about after the fall of the Soviet Union. And you have NATO expansion, and, you know, East Bloc countries were NATO. This is more like a column for the Gulf, where I spent a bunch of time. There's sort of this convenient fiction that NATO and the United States are really different. But they're not, because the real force comes from the United States. You can have it however you want. But this has been the United States. I think what we've seen in Afghanistan began to force a redefinition of NATO. And what we've seen in Libya will move even more down that line. I'm not a NATO guy, I'm not a Europe guy, but as I think about Middle Eastern, I gotta think that NATO means NATO. NATO doesn't mean the United States plus your people in colorful little union.
Sir, Justin Ansel, Command Staff College. Two quick questions. One, has there been any thought or consideration of getting Libyan expats or living abroad to go back to Libya to help with the transitional government and maybe somebody from the U.S.? And the second question is, what role do you see the social media playing in the future of the, not only transitional government, but of that area of the world?
Okay. I think some Libyans have gone back. Ali Karkouni, as I said, is a leader of this government. He's a professor in the United States. Some have gone back. I think at this point it's still a high risk, high reward. I worry some of my Libyan expatriate friends said, this is just too screwy. I can't do that. I just live my life. You know, the Afghan experience, a lot of Afghans went back, a lot of Palestinians went back. I mean, it's not always a happy story when people go back. Although some people, Sanat Fayyad, was working at the IMF, and he's, I think, quite successful in policy. Some, I think some will go back. I think it is important for Libya to attract people because we're, I do think, first, Gaddafi really forced the qualified people out of the country. And it's a huge access to the talent of the Libyans. Everyone else was. And if you're dealing with a small country, you don't have that many people anywhere. A lot of the talent are overseas. And to my mind, having been to Libya, this is a country that systematically destroyed its own human capital for 41 years. That in order to keep the government in place, they created a social system based entirely on loyalty and not on ability or effort. And so then you have people in positions of authority who distrust people who either work hard or have ability because they're a threat to people who are loyal because you would do the work for them, right? And the only way to work under Gaddafi is to be loyal because Gaddafi had both tortured and enriched everybody in his inner circle. And there was no question he was the one in control. So this whole sort of loyalty, purity, occupied by a huge number of people with absolute no ability. And you have a whole generation of people in India who have no idea what excellence looks like, because they've never seen in their entire lives. I think one of the things that you need to do is to bring back Libyans who have some sense of it, to bring back Libyans who can lead this into a different. And there are some. There are some Libyans who either studied overseas in the 70s or Libyans who used to work for the banks and the oil companies back in the 60s and have sort of a baseline. But you really have a generation and a half of Libyans. And I don't know how you help mold them into productive citizens. You know, citizens in terms of the state, productive in terms of economic activity. In general, it's an oil economy. Oil economies don't produce jobs except for government. It's a deep problem. And expatriates can help that, but it's a real awful slog, and it's an uncertain slog.
Second question on social media.
Oh, social media. Libya is not especially wired, as you might imagine. How wired it gets, how quickly, I don't know. I sense that Libyans are sort of unsure both how to lead and how to follow, so how that plays out, independently, some watching. In general, I think people have overestimated the importance of social media as a mass phenomenon in the Middle East. And an article in the in the fall edition of the Washington Quarterly, entitled The Revolution Will Not Be Tweeted, which talks about the role of social media in the Egyptian uprisings. It seems to me that you can use social media to get a few hundred people to do things. There was a Facebook group, sort of Egyptian protest Facebook group, named after an online activist who had been beaten to death by the police in Alexandria called We're All Khalil Saeed, and had 450,000 members on the eve of this Egyptian uprising. Working with this group, sending out a message to 450,000 people, they could get a few hundred to the protest on the 25th of January. When you have a few hundred people chanting in poor neighborhoods of economic concerns, you can go to a few thousand. When you go to a few thousand, suddenly you have a television event. And when you have a television event, you have an audience of tens of millions. 70% of Egyptians have satellite television their own. 98% of Egyptians have a television their own. More Egyptians have a television in their homes than have a chair. True. And when you have these things that go out over television, you create this incredible narrative. Because if you think about it, television is this amazing medium for telling stories. Yeah, reality TV, it tells these great stories, right? And television is awesome at telling stories that are emotionally involved. And what you could do is you could say, this is a revolution. And Al Jazeera didn't call what was happening in Tunisia a revolution until 3 days before Ben Ali fled the country. But 3 days into the Egyptian protest, Al Jazeera said, this is a revolution. This is a revolution. And that, I think, swelled the crowds and helped get tens of millions of people into the street. Start to finish, Egypt in 15 years. Where I think social media comes in is not so much that you can get information out to people. So I think the information ends up being fairly ubiquitous. What the social media does, to my mind, is it helps people overcome that boundary of being an activist. But if you think about, has anybody here been to boot camp? Right? What do they do to you? I don't know. I went to a museum. That's close enough for me. But you guys all go through a process to make you willing to risk your lives for the world and for this country. If you got an email, would you risk your life for it? But what social media does, it helps people jump over that barrier to I'm an activist, that's who I am, because I sent a video, because I filmed something on my phone and I sent it to a bunch of people. Right? And you, by acting, by voting with your actions, you become an activist. And to my mind, where social media really played a role in Egypt was not it allowed people to receive all these messages and figure out what was happening. No, it allowed people in a short period of time to say, I am with them. By my actions, I am with them, and therefore I'm willing to take risks. And if you think about the kinds of processes by which people get involved in movements, oftentimes this takes place over years. Right, from going to churches, synagogues, oftentimes it takes years to get your money. Universities, you go for 4 years, then after that they start asking for money. Right, I mean, all these things. It takes time to develop those kinds of ties. Egypt, as I said, 18 days start to finish. It's weird that people would be willing to take a risk after such a tiny, tiny, tiny period of time. And I think where social media played a role was because it allowed people to say, I am an activist because I have done X, and therefore I am also willing to do Y and Z. And that's another one.
Getting back on that point, don't you think social media can be at least a trigger, whereas a TV takes it once it happens and creates the movement, but start a riot or start a gathering which could become violent or not violent, or burn something, where it becomes newsworthy, if you would. Can social media be that trigger to start?
Reportedly, it didn't in London over summer. It's supposed to be so hard to communicate. But I think in those cases, in many cases, you're looking at very small numbers of people who are involved. I think what I see happening in the Middle East is that you do have a tiny board, which uses all kinds of social media very sophisticated. But again, this issue of a mass movement, I mean, this is a movement that transcended class, age, location, became nationwide. And I think there is something about the measure of seeing something on television and feeling that it's national and touches you, and the magic of being able to essentially vote with your phone before you vote with your feet.
Please, Rob Tappanini, History Division. I came in late, so forgive me if I miss this one, but.
Who's Rob Levine?
What role? In a broader sense, the Arab Spring, why 2011? What, have you looked back at where this all started, you know, and I've piggybacking on the social media question, that's what I've been itching to ask and itching to find out is where is this going? You know, you hear about flash mobs in the United States and things like New York Times, you know, what's going on at the Wall Street. And you hear about flash mobs in Maryland at gas stations. Where is this going? And why 2011 for all of these revolts, revolutions?
Here's my theory. Everybody who was paying attention did not think it would happen in 2011. One of my advisors in graduate school just finished a manuscript in December called Arab Presidents for Life. It's under revision. Everybody who's paying attention didn't see this. I think what happened in Libya simply didn't make sense. It doesn't go by any of the rules we know about why these things happen. It happened, it started 200 miles outside of the capital, in some place nobody paid attention to. It wasn't wired, right? I mean, there wasn't a way to get all this information out. Low internet penetration, very low social media use. It got spread by labor unions. They don't pay attention to labor unions as political actors anymore, other than the Democratic Party. I mean, it's academically, labor unions as political actors, we don't do that. Right? You had this incredible police state, which was totally ineffective stopping the protests. They were 3 days of protests in the capital city, and the army, which had previously been totally inert as a force in Tunisian life, told the president it's time for you to leave. So I think Tunisia doesn't fit any model anybody could ever have of how change works. It was what they call black swan. Have never seen one. You can't prove it doesn't exist, but nobody's ever seen one. So you sort of assume it doesn't exist, and sometimes you see one. Television certainly played a role, but I think not the leading. From that, you suddenly have the spark. And Egypt was a tinderbox. Right? Egypt had this very difficult economic problems, not on a macro level, but on an individual level. Very high youth unemployment. Right? People who finished college utterly unable to get jobs for years and years and years. Prices were going up, especially for things like meat, tomatoes, things like that. There was a sense that the country was sort of frozen because the president was 83, he was getting less mobile, less active, but there was no transition. The military didn't seem comfortable with the president's son, but there didn't seem to be an alternative to the president's son. So this country is really, I would argue, more and more labor protests. The country is a tinderbox. And suddenly you have the spark of Tunisia. Spark lands on the kingdom. Then you have this thing with television and social media interacting. Then you have Al Jazeera really piling up. You have 10,000 people in Tahrir Square, Al Jazeera is that's zero. The zero after, not before the 100,000 people in Tahrir Square. This is a revolution. Then the military does incredibly, or then, sorry, the president does incredibly stupid things. Do you remember the scenes the day of the camels, when the guys rode in the camels to beat the protesters. How could you forget that? It's a made-for-television moment, right? That just, it totally changed what everybody thought. So you have Egypt, so first you have Tunisia, which is about 6 weeks. Egypt takes 18 days start to finish. Egypt's a big deal in the Arab world. It's the center of gravity for the Arab world. It's 82 million people. It is a lot of the broadcasters, the news guys, the authors, people, school teachers were Egyptian, doctors were Egyptian, and lawyers were Egyptian. I mean, Egypt exports a lot of labor all over the place. Everybody knows Egyptian. And everybody knows Egyptian songs, and everybody knows Egyptian films. And there's a way in which Egypt gave this all an immediacy, and suddenly it becomes universal, right? Because Egypt's a big deal. Then you have the response, the Bahrain, where the Saudis come in and say, not here anymore. And you have, I think what you will have is a back and forth of governments trying to learn a lesson, of protesters trying to learn a lesson, and I think you'll have a 10-year effort by each side to try to redefine the relationship. Arguably, Bashar al-Assad thinks that he has learned the lessons of Ben Ali and Gubar. Right? Because the lessons are, you don't make a lot of concessions early, you keep the army on your side, you try to limit the amount of media so you don't have this become an international incident, right? Because Ben Ali kept trying to give concessions until he got on a plane to Saudi Arabia. Reportedly chided by his wife at the time for totally screwing everything up. A Libyan, a Lebanese who works for a Libyan, sort of smugly told me that. Said Gaddafi won't go. Gaddafi had the NATO troops for six months during an air campaign, and you know all the other things that were going on the ground with us and our friends. But Syria, they held on. Saleh in Yemen, I think he's going. He hasn't gone. I mean, you could argue that the governments have actually regained their balance by learning the lessons of Ben Ali and war. And this is going to be a much more uncertain back and forth. There have been, Libya, as I said, Libya becomes a very special case because of the Allied war. But in these other countries, there haven't been other governments that have fallen. There certainly haven't been these sort of flash fires like we had in Egypt. And I think we're not likely to see them again. Instead, we're likely to see a real jostling, both to define the post-transition environment in these countries that are transitioning, and the efforts of governments to forestall transitions in their own country. I think it is certainly going to dominate this region for the next decade. And that it's not just on the social level, but on the international relations level. You have countries such as Saudi Arabia who look and they try to think about geopolitics. They say, well, our geopolitics are based on the Iraqis keeping the Iranians at bay. That's why we kept giving them money to fight the Iranians. Except Iraq is A, completely self-absorbed, and B, in the Saudi market, taken over by the Shia anyway. So they become pro-Iran instead of a war against the Iranians. Then they rely on Egypt. Right, Syria's military, 82 million people, except Egypt is totally solid. So if you're Saudi Arabia, where do you look for strategic depth in the Middle East? The fact is there's no other country, no other Arab country that can do for Saudi Arabia, for its Arab policy, what Iraq and Egypt did. So I think the Saudis are turning more and more toward Turkey to find a sort of like-minded Sunni country that can give them some depth. But I think you're going to see a whole repositioning of regional alliances, a whole sense of what's the United States about, what kind of relationship you need with the United States, what kind of relationships you need with other countries to compensate for things the U.S. can't do. I think so on both the domestic level and the regional level, I think we're in an extended period of redefinition of the Middle East, not because we reached a tipping point, not because something predictable happened, but but something totally unpredictable happened. It ignited this tinderbox in Egypt, and then totally changed the whole balance in the region. It's like it continued for some time.
So just a follow-up on the Lieutenant General Chris Spanis hat, then what is the U.S.'s role in all this? What should our role be, according to you?
That's a great question. I don't think there's an obvious role. I'll tell you one of my take-home conclusions. For a long time, we used to think of these places as police states, right? They're run by the secret police. They're police states. But I think the conclusion that we have to draw from what happened in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Bahrain, is these are army states. The people who decide whether the government stands or falls, not the internal intelligence apparatus, it's the army. Now, as military, we have relationships with army. But our diplomats don't really talk to armies because our diplomats talk to civilian leaders. And armies say, we don't need diplomacy because we're, right, that's not our lane. I think one of the things we're going to have to do better over the next decade is figure out how to coordinate better within ourselves to deal with what are essentially military-led governments, to find ways for military to deliver diplomatic messages, and to find ways to push the military to engage more with other things. I think we have an interest in working on some of the underlying economic problems of these countries. That there is, at core, I think all of this unrest is about a deep human capital problem. That they both don't train people well for jobs, both in terms of their actual knowledge, in terms of motivation, creativity, all those kinds of things. And there aren't jobs for people to get. And unless we figure some part of that equation out with them, unless we can help catalyze constructive efforts in that regard, I think we're going to have a lot of problems in this region, not only now, but even more, when the oil stops to become as valuable a commodity in 20 years' time. Right? Or Middle Eastern states run out of oil. And then you're left with people with sky-high expectations, no ability to really be productive, an awful lot of anger. So it may be that they're really difficult times for the United States. Maybe. And I hope you don't get this. But the really difficult times for the United States and the Middle East may not be now. The really difficult time may be in 40 years' time when the economic situation really deteriorates because oil becomes less valuable. And you have people with tremendous expectations, tremendous energy costs, tremendous financial burdens, and no way to pay those bills.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.